Blog Talk Radio.
Glad you could be here on Monday, February the 2nd. I'm your host, Susan Knowles, and this is Stand for Truth Radio. I understand also for those of you listening in Texas that today is Chris Kyle Day. Apparently you have a governor who seems to understand and listen to his constituents. That's nice to know. And we also found out today that there's going to be 6 more weeks of winter. So hopefully you are in a climate that's warm and really it won't make one bit of difference. And I hope everybody out there had a great week. I had a little incident on Saturday where I severely sprained my ankle and chipped a bone. So if you hear any screaming, I hope it won't be loud and hope it'll just be me and not our guest. So I should be able to get through this all just fine. If you have any questions, the chat room is open. And, of course, you can always call in at 347-205-9620, 347-205-9620. And I will be watching the chat room if you do have any questions. We're so fortunate tonight to have a great guest. He is Derek Wilburn. He is the founder, president, and chairman of the board of Rocky Mountain Black Conservatives, the founder, president, and chairman of American Conservatives of Color, and that's at blackandconservative.com. He's also a columnist, and so I want to bring him on so he can explain a little bit more about who he is and what he does. And so I want to make a great and warm welcome to you, Derek Wilburn. How are you?
How am I? I am... furious, fit to be tied, uptight, disappointed, ready to rail, and other than that, everything's great.
That's fine. Well, I think probably most of the country feels the same way you do, so I know this is going to be a great evening.
I am so sick and tired of this Negro in our White House. I'm ready to choke somebody, but okay, let's do it.
All right, let's get to a little bit about your background and who you are and on these groups that you're in, and tell me a little bit about each one of them, if you will.
I am basically an accidental political activist. I had never been involved in politics in my life other than voting and what have you, like most people, up until a few years ago. In 2010, I've been fundamentally conservative for 25 years. I mean, in my mind, some things, what does skin color have to do with it? And we can talk about that. But in 2009 and 10, we were all getting more and more frustrated, getting angry at the TV. You know, Obama had the White House. The liberals had both houses of Congress, and they're putting stuff through in the middle of the night and ramming stuff through that nobody wanted, and they just didn't care. They stopped listening. And I realized sitting here getting angry at the TV isn't changing anything, and I need to either get involved or shut my mouth. So I hosted an event at my home. We had a senatorial race at that time. Our incumbent liberal Democrat senator was being challenged by a Republican guy named Ken Buck. And I called Ken Buck's campaign office, and I said, you know, you Republicans historically get a very small percentage of the black vote, and some of that's your fault. I mean, we feel like you don't show up. We feel like you just don't care. If you would like to come to my house and have a forum with some minority voters, I will host it. I can get them here. I can fill up a whole house full of black folks if you want to come explain to us why you deserve our vote. And he came. And that was August of 2010 in my backyard. We had 30 or 40 people. The pictures are on the internet to this day. And it was a very powerful afternoon. So a month or two later, I decided, well, maybe we should do that again. And we did. And then I decided, well, maybe we should do it again. And we did. And I went from having 30 or 40 people in my backyard to 50 to 60 to 100 to 200 and grew to another city and grew to another state. And next thing you know, I tripped, fell down, and stood up a political activist.
Wow. Nice. And then when did you start the two organizations? About the same time or after that?
We began as the Rocky Mountain Black Tea Party. The Tea Party movement was alive and well in those days, and still is, but you don't still see the same sort of steam that you saw in the early days. And that was in late 2010. We became the Rocky Mountain Black Conservatives shortly thereafter because I wanted to broaden the appeal a little bit. And we actually have a plan that we put on the ground for ethnic minority outreach that's quite effective, and people in other parts of the country began to get interested in it. And I like the name Rocky Mountain Black Conservatives, but that doesn't work in Florida. It doesn't work
exactly
in New Hampshire. So we needed a national organization. And that's when I set up the American Conservatives of Color, which is our national organization, whereas the Rocky Mountain Black Conservatives is more centered here in the Rocky Mountain region where I live.
Okay. And well, what kind of things do you run into? And, you know, when you're going out there and talking to people, what are you finding, you know, with Black America, White America, Asian America, what kind of things are being presented to you and in those group meetings?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and there's a lot of different directions to take it, but here's where I think the rubber meets the road and probably what your listeners are most wanting to hear, because everyone knows right now the makeup of the electorate in our country is such that if the conservative party does not do a better job of penetrating and attracting ethnic minority voters in for big problems,
mm-hmm.
Everyone knows that. America is turning brown. Everyone knows. And the demographic face of the Democrat Party is changing with it. The demographic face of the Republican Party is not. And that's the challenge. But what you see is, you know, the white vote in this country, the Caucasian vote, is about 50-50. It
mm-hmm.
always is. It's right around 50-50. But the black vote is 90-10, and the Hispanic vote is 70-30. So if we ethnic minorities voted more like the rest of the country, you know, liberals couldn't elect a county dog catcher. That's how important it is. So you hear a lot, what I hear a lot from white people, from Caucasians, is, you know, mm-hmm. we'd love to do the inclusive thing. We'd love to do the outreach thing. We know it's important, but how? How do we actually go about doing it? It's difficult. I don't look right. I don't sound right. I feel like they think I'm a racist before I even open my mouth in the first place. You know, it's very uncomfortable. So what I did is I put together a plan. You know, we actually have a written plan, 5 specific steps. These are the things that you can begin doing as a candidate, as an elected official, as a grassroots activist, to start the process of turning over the ground and getting it ready for some seeds so that we can begin getting across that bridge.
And is it true that if, let's say, you know, a white person goes to a meeting with all black people, and I know this is generalizing, but I'm just saying, if that were to happen, would there be people in the black community that would be receptive to that person if they had the correct message, or does it have to be, you have to be the same color in order for the message to be received?
No, the former, of course. I mean, of course, mm-hmm. there's going to be people on the extremes on both sides of the fence.
Right,
but
absolutely.
But the message that I've been trying to sell, and with some success, I might add, to conservatives, to Republicans, Tea Partiers, libertarians, whatever label you want to put on yourself, is it is a mistake to go into the ethnic minority community, the urban community, the black community, and begin talking about why your policies are better. We
mm-hmm.
aren't there
right.
yet. What we first have to do is start asking people, how many kids do you have? We have to first work on building relationship. Once the relationships are in place, then we can start talking about the votes. The Republican Party has been trying this the other way around for 50 years, and it doesn't work. So what they do is they'll take their person, their gal or their guy, and say, here's what we believe, and here's what we stand for, and here's what we're going to do if you vote for us, here's why you need to vote for us. And then the Democrats take their person, they do the same thing. Here's what we believe, and here's why you ought to vote for us. We aren't there yet. First, we've got to spend some time in the community, shaking hands, kissing babies, developing some name and face recognition. Once we've got the cred, then we can ask for the vote.
Because it seems like there's a lack of trust. And you know, this is with every group. I mean, I think, you know, whites as well. You know, we're getting to the point, we don't trust the Republican Party. They come in, they say before the election, we're going to go in, we're going to do X, Y, and Z, we're going to repeal Obamacare, we're going to do this and that and the other. And then they go in, and they immediately do something totally the opposite. So, you know, it's so difficult to build trust, and then I think, you know, white America is losing trust in their own party. So we've got a double problem here.
Well, we're losing trust in politicians, period, and rightfully so. I couldn't be a bigger proponent of term limits than – you'll never find someone who's more in favor of term limits than I am for that very reason. But your point is well stated. So the Republican version of outreach – for my entire lifetime, has been, okay, we're going to parachute in a team of people, walk around the neighborhood 6 weeks before an election handing out flyers saying, oh, by the way, we care about you too. That's not outreach.
Right.
That's an insult.
Right. Absolutely. And how do they, you know, again, how do the Republicans change that? Because they do that in every neighborhood. I mean, they do that with, you know, you only see them right before the election, you know. Otherwise, you really don't hear from them. And then right before the election, oh, my gosh, I'm right there for you, you know. And people know and they feel a lot of times that just isn't true. And that's for everybody. So how do you convince somebody who's even farther down the road with that lack of trust that they need to start trusting the Republican Party, and that when they do, if they do come into your neighborhood and talk to you, that they're going to do what they say they're going to do?
You can't convince them with words. You can only convince them with action. And that's the whole point of the plan. You can't tell somebody, I'm going to start showing up. You've got to actually start showing up. And we've done this successfully. We had several very competitive races here in Colorado, won some, lost some. But where we took and worked with the Republican candidates and showed them, you know, this is what you need to do to begin showing up and developing some trust in the community. You know, there are people in the minority community who are looking for an option. That there is low-hanging fruit, but they aren't finding one. So, you know, I've made this statement in many, many forums. The issue that Black America has with the Republican Party is not policy-based. It's not. There are some exceptions, of course. I mean, no one agrees with everybody's policy position 100%. But it isn't policy. It's lack of relationship. And the way I prove that is to point at Detroit, Michigan. Detroit, Michigan, everyone knows what's happening in Detroit, Michigan. It's no big secret. The city, you know, one of the greatest cities on the face of the earth 30 years ago is now gone. I mean, it's bankrupt. All the buildings are being torn down. The whole city is gone. Well, Detroit is the nation's heaviest per capita populated Black city. So 88% of the residents of Detroit are Blacks. Yet last November, when the elections came around, 90% of the Blacks in Detroit voted for Democrats. So that tells me that the issue was not policy.
Right?
I mean, if people were making these decisions based on policy, there isn't a Black person in Detroit who would so much as consider voting for a Democrat. I mean, their policies have ruined their lives, but they all did. So the issue isn't policy. The issue is a lack of relationship. And until we get a bridge built across the relationship river, there will be no votes.
So let's say that before the election, you know, Republicans went into Detroit to try to convince them that, you know, hey, we're here for you. And let's say far enough in advance so that we could start building the trust. What specific things could they have done for the people of Detroit that could have changed their mind?
Very good question. Here's some simple ones, very simple ones. Republicans, conservatives, libertarian, you know, whatever. We're saying Republican, but we understand that umbrella is bigger than that. Republicans can begin by showing up in the community at ethnic minority-sponsored social events and festivals. So in every city in the country, we do this here in Denver, Colorado, faithfully. You have, just this last month, you had the Martin Luther King Day celebration. Here in Denver, we had a big parade, a big march down the street, 20,000 people, a festival. You could have a booth down there, be shaking hands, meeting people, just developing face and name recognition. These things happen in ethnic minority communities from coast to coast. Martin Luther King Day, Cinco de Mayo Day. Juneteenth celebrations. These things are festivals and activities put on by the ethnic minority community, and it's a great place to develop some name and face recognition in an atmosphere where people are already festive, they're already in a good mood, they're not down there looking for a fight. So here's what Mr. or Mrs. Elected Republican in Detroit, well, if there are any, or Birmingham or Atlanta or New York or Boston, wherever. If there's a Cinco de Mayo festival, and there is, go down there, get one of those 10-by-10-foot pipe and drape booths. You know, there's 200 of them. Be down there with your staff, wearing your T-shirts, with a helium tank, filling up balloons, giving them to babies, shaking hands, kissing babies, telling people, you know what, hi, my name is James Turner. I'm House Representative for District 27. I work for you and the people in this community. Just wanted to meet you and your family. If you ever have any questions, here's where my office is. Feel free to stop by anytime. Beautiful family. I hope you have a great day. That's it. Not asking for votes. Not telling anybody they're an idiot because they voted for Obama. Not arguing about abortion. Just down there developing name and face recognition. That's where it starts.
Just being a human being and relating to people.
Because right now you aren't.
Right. And
right now you're the boogeyman.
And I was going to say, that has also been helped by our president. You know, I mean, I don't think race relations have been any worse than they are right now. Maybe, you know, maybe a little bit worse in the 60s. I don't know. But again, I was alive in the 60s. I remember race riots and everything else in my school, on and on and on. And I thought those days were gone. And I thought relationships were getting better. And I don't know, maybe I'm alone on this, but I feel that Obama has set us back so far. And people like Al Sharpton. Like, how do you overcome that to get back and you know, reach out to people with that sort of handicap, if you will?
Yeah, you're right and you're wrong. You're right. It's gotten worse. It's not gotten better. You would think that in a nation where over 50% of white people who vote voted for a black man to be their president, that we would be able to move past that. The idea and the notion that race relations in the country have never been worse, of course, that's not true. I mean, they used to round up black people, have a picnic, and hang them. So I mean, things have been much worse. But I know what you're saying. I understand the sentiment behind the statement, and we're talking about 150 years ago. But of course, it's been worse. We've come a long way. But the president and the Al Sharptons of the world, they could do a lot to introduce healing. But frankly, it's not in their better interest.
There's no money in that.
There's no money in it, and right now you've got, black Americans, essentially we're cattle on a vote plantation. We're cattle on a vote farm. They've got 90% of our votes. So bringing about healing and reinforcing the narrative that conservatives are not racists, but conservatives do want what's best for you, they just have a better, a different idea about how we go about those things, that's not in their better interest. So they have no interest in doing those things, and they aren't going to.
And, a couple months ago, I had a gentleman on by the name of Daniel Garza, who is the founder of the Libra Initiative. And he's kind of doing the same thing you are. He's trying to show and tell Hispanics that, hey, being conservative can be a good thing. It can help you. It can help you get what you're looking for and what you've always wanted and, on and on and on. So he's going out in the communities and doing outreach himself and trying to, spread the word. I think he's, coming with a lot of success. And it sounds like the things that you're doing also is helping to expand that base. I'm always taken aback about how anybody even voted for Obama the first time, but then to go and do it a second time when you saw, what happened during the first term, and it's like that blows my mind. I don't know how anybody could do that. I mean, how do you do that? I mean, obviously, help me out here. How do you do that?
You're right. It's the Obama zombie effect. The Obama zombie effect is unlike anything I've ever seen. I wrote about this two, 3 years ago. It's almost like the Force in Star Wars. There's a scene in Star Wars when Obi-Wan is in the land speeder with Luke, and he's teaching him about the Force and how you control the weak-minded and all that other stuff. And they come up to the stormtroopers, and the stormtroopers say, "We need to see your papers." And Obi-Wan says, "You don't need to see his papers." And the stormtrooper says, "We don't need to see his papers." And the stormtrooper says, "We're looking for some droids." And Obi-Wan says, "These aren't the droids. He can go on his way." So the stormtrooper says, "These aren't the droids. You can go on your way." It's the same thing.
I remember
that. It's the same thing. You can literally take things that Obama said less than a year ago, and he has said the exact opposite. Not sort of, kind of different. 180 degrees, completely opposite what he used to say. And millions of people in this country's response to that is, "Well, yeah, he didn't say that."
I know.
It's nothing short of remarkable.
It's absolutely mind-blowing. Who, if you had to choose today for a candidate, and I know we're really early in the game, but looking down the road for president, who looks good to you?
It is too early. I don't know. I like some of the field we're looking at right now. I can honestly say there's really no one in the field that I would simply say no, cannot vote for that person. Absolutely, positively, not on my children's eyeballs. Couldn't do it. A lot of problems with Jeb Bush and his embracement of Common Core. I need to find out about that. He'd probably be the last on my list. But when I look across the field and I see Rubio and Rand Paul and Ted Cruz and Scott Walker and Ben Carson, I really have very few problems with a lot of these people. I like a lot of what Scott Walker has done in Wisconsin, which, by the way, Scott Walker and I went to high school together.
Wow.
Kind of a strange thing, but he's taken it to him, and he took the unions on the chin and showed a lot of fortitude. So I like some of the things I'm hearing out of him. I like Rand Paul's positions on probably 90% of the things that he talks about. So I'm pretty comfortable with the bench right now. I think we're going to ultimately get a tremendous politician, And if we don't get a tremendous politician, that means I hope we get Ben Carson.
Yeah.
Because he's not a politician. It's about time we get a doctor or a businessman or somebody else in there.
Well, and that's what this was all set up for anyway. It's not, you know, the Constitution and everything else and the Founding Fathers, they didn't have in mind that, you know, somebody would come in and make a career out of this and be a politician. They wanted, you know, Americans, you know, to walk through there, just people like you and me to walk through there and get into office and represent the people. And, you know,
yeah.
Dr. Carson, I mean, I've only heard one thing that kind of alarmed me a little, and it was just a little, and that was on Second Amendment, but I think he kind of explained what he meant by that, and that was an assault rifle he was talking about. Other than that, I haven't heard anything that I don't like.
Well, and there's no such thing as a candidate with whom you're going to agree 100% on everything. Here's
exactly
one of the things that we have to stop doing. On our side of the fence, we got to stop doing this. Because, you know, we're not sheeple over here.
Right.
On the right side of the fence, we're libertarian, we're conservative party, we're constitutionalist party, we're Republicans, we're entrepreneurs. You know, this is herding cats to begin with. And so you have people who, my pet issue is Second Amendment. My pet issue is life. My pet issue is the sanctity of marriage. Whatever it is. I mean, we all have those things, and we all have those groups, and some of those groups have organized into PACs and what have you, and they have some dollars to spend or whatever. But then they'll get a candidate who doesn't line up exactly with what they believe on that topic, and so come Tuesday in November, they stay home.
I can't vote for that guy.
He doesn't agree with me on assault rifles. He doesn't agree with me on life of the mother. He doesn't agree with me on, you know, whatever it is, and so we stay home. That's a mistake.
Right.
We're not going to find a perfect candidate. The issues are too broad, too deep, and too frequent. Such a person doesn't exist. But to your first point, and I couldn't agree with you more, I've been preaching this for years. Unfortunately, we've reached the point in this country where only politicians can be politicians because the barriers to entry are so high. There's
Absolutely.
A reason. You know, we've got Congress with a 9% approval rating, but a 94% reelection rate. So everyone hates Congress, but everyone votes for their congressman. Because, you know, come election time, these people snap their fingers and $20 million of PAC money shows up or super PAC money shows up or special interest money shows up. And here's Derek and Suzanne running around house to house doing in-home fundraisers, collecting checks for $50 here or $100 there. You haven't got a hope. And that's why these people have been in there for 30 years. You can't get rid of them.
Right. No, you absolutely can't. And, you know, It kind of also, even the up-and-coming people, let's say, in Congress, they don't have the money. They can't get all the donations. I mean, like a Ted Cruz, he's going to have difficulty because he doesn't have that name recognition as, let's say, you know, Lindsey Graham, God forbid. I said that out loud, too, didn't I? No, but it's going to be difficult for him.
No, you didn't. You didn't thought that. You didn't say it. Yeah, it's very challenging.
That's right. I didn't say it.
You did. You just thought it. You just thought it really loudly. Well, unfortunately, I mean, it's all about the money. And unfortunately, that's the case, but that's the case. Right now, to win a Senate seat, you're looking at anywhere from $6 to $20 million. If you're talking about New York, Florida, California, you know, a big state, you're talking $20 million. To win a House seat, again, depending upon the district, but you're still talking $400,000 to five, possibly $6 or $7 million. That's not easy to do. That's not easy to do. And if you can do it, you're going to win. A guy once told me you can take out anybody if you can outspend them, if you can come up with the money. And unfortunately, that's where we are in this country, but that's where we are, and that's why we have a 94% reelection rate for a bunch of people that nobody can stand.
Right. And one of the things out here in California is that in, I believe, 2018, you know, Dianne Feinstein is up for perhaps retiring. And the rumor has it that Michelle Obama may run for her seat. And I'm trying to figure out where else to go if and when that happens, because Californians will vote her in.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, and Feinstein, let's start with Dianne Feinstein, 81 years old. 81. Barbara Boxer has announced she's not going to run. She's your junior senator. Right. She's 76.
Right.
Harry Reid, 78. If I were going to attempt to run a corporation, I'm going to start up a company and I've got some dollars and I want to make this thing happen, I want to surround myself with the best, brightest, most energetic, you know, all that stuff, I would not go out and hire a bunch of 70 and 80-year-olds to run my company. Nothing against 80-year-olds, but I just wouldn't. But that's who we have running our country.
You would have those 80-year-olds in place to ask them questions to learn wisdom. But you would have other people who were doing the day-to-day stuff that could keep up with the pace of what it took in order to get things done for most positions. And running the country, I think, probably qualifies, you know, as one of those positions that you need to have a little energy and not as many years on you.
You'd think. Now, I hadn't heard that about Michelle Obama. I guess they could move their established residency just like the Clintons did, and Hillary ran for the Senate seat out there.
Right.
But this is a woman who has been disbarred. This is a woman who doesn't have the deepest of resume. Unfortunately, that doesn't matter anymore. It's just a matter of swag. If you've got enough swag, you can get the job done. Arguably, you could say you got a governor who had done a little bit more other than portray a cyborg in a few movies, and that was enough to get him elected.
Well, it was wanting to get rid of Gray Davis that really got Arnold Schwarzenegger elected, because we wanted Gray Davis out more than we cared about having Arnold in the first place. We didn't have anybody really to run against him. And then, you know, now we've got Jerry Brown, who basically this is his last term, thank God.
You're better off with Davis.
Yeah, I know. But and Jerry Brown, you may see him making a bid for the White House sometime soon, because he's not going to stop with just California. He thinks he's doing the best job out here. So you're going to see his face in other places. And he's in his 70s. Yeah.
Let us pray. Yeah. I hope he wins the Democrat nomination. That would be sweet. about the time that he's getting his campaign firing is about the time that the rumors are swirling that California has no choice but to file for bankruptcy.
Right. Oh, yeah. It'll be there someday, probably.
Well, California. Last I checked, California hemorrhages somewhere in the neighborhood of $20 million a month. It's a lot of money.
Yeah, that's a lot of money.
A lot of money. Well, you've got union. Go ahead.
Oh yeah. No, I was going to, yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. And it's just it's a matter of time. I think people are trying to hold on and not be Detroit is what we're trying to do. Or like
well,
New York,
that,
I mean, we're waiting.
The thing is, there's no escaping that trap. And this is one of the reasons I like Scott Walker and he did the right thing in Wisconsin, because what eventually happens when you have CalPERS and these other massive unionized labor states like Detroit, like the entire state of California, that's a model that cannot help but to fail. So I hire you to teach or to drive a fire truck or to drive a school bus or whatever you do for the state, and I pay you $50,000 a year. You reach the retirement age of 64. You retire, but you have a contract that says I still have to pay you 80% of what you used to earn, plus I have to hire somebody to replace you, do the job you used to do. So now I'm paying two people to do the job of one. And if you live, I mean, if you survive into your 70s, 80s, maybe even your 90s, the person who replaced you reaches retirement age. I got to pay him or her 80% of their former salary and hire a new person. So now I'm paying three people to do the job of one. It's just a matter of time until that model explodes upon itself. The difference is with states and cities, they don't have printing presses like the feds do that they can run all night to cover it, and they can't go borrow it from China.
Well, exactly. And we're also paying for illegal immigrants in California and have been for many, many years as far as, you know, health care, as far as now driver's licenses, going to school, you name it. And it just keeps going more and more.
Oh, yeah.
And the people who really have a lot of money have left California. So you've got the middle class.
The taxes are too high. Yeah, the taxes are too high. So people have gotten it. And it's an expensive place to run in the first place. It's an expensive state. Yeah, you've got a very wide and ranging topography and geography. You've got deserts. You've got mountains. You're going to have issues with wildfires. You've got a lot of parks. The state park system is very intricate. Many, many miles and miles and miles of state-maintained highways. It's an expensive state to run. You need a lot of people, and you need a lot of people at the top. And it's inevitable. So let us pray that Jerry Brown wins the nomination, and 2 days later, the state of California makes the announcement that we need to get bailed out or file bankruptcy and default on all our creditors, and that gets Scott Walker in.
Yeah, well, I'll keep my fingers crossed on that, I think. I'm not really sure how that's going to work out. I'm afraid that the country would say, oh, you know, Jerry Brown's so great. Let's just get him in there, and that would be, oh, my gosh. Let's talk about the article that you wrote for freedomsjournal.net with the third gender. Can you tell us about that article?
The third gender. We are in a very dangerous place in our country. Conventional wisdom, traditional wisdom, logic and wisdom that any three-year-old has is that there are two genders, male and female. We all know that. The mm-hmm. current massively liberal leadership in our country and in places like California is now saying that there is a third gender. That is what I identify as. So
right.
the fact that I was born with a certain type of plumbing isn't what determines my gender. What determines my gender is what I think or say that I am. The point being, in a conservative standpoint, is look, if you're a man and you put on lipstick, makeup, and a dress every day, that doesn't make you a woman. That makes you a man wearing a dress.
Exactly.
Well, what the mm-hmm. liberal establishment is saying is no, that gives you the rights to exercise all the privileges of being female, including using showers and restroom facilities and things like that. And they're pushing this legislative agenda through. They're pushing this policy agenda through as fast as they can. And as a father of a 14-year-old daughter, I do not want my daughter exposed to men's penises in bathrooms because those
right.
men claim that they're women. You do not have the right to behave. You can behave any way you want. Look, if your employer is fine with you coming in a dress every day, not my business, not my problem, I don't care. It doesn't affect me.
Exactly.
But that doesn't give you the right to be a woman, and it certainly doesn't give you the right to be one on my dime.
Mm-hmm.
So all that's changing now, and it's a very, very dangerous path.
And do you think this is just another progressive agenda plan to say, see how accepting we are. We're all inclusive. Everybody is included. We don't want anybody to feel left out. So it's just one more person to get on the Democrat ticket.
Yes and no. There's certainly some element of that. But for the people who are hardcore, Barack Obama's mm-hmm. and Jerry Brown's of the world, this is in their DNA. They believe this. There are people walking around this country, and I've written about this many times, when they see a bathroom with the words men or women above the entrance, they view those words the exact same way as people viewed colored and whites in 1940.
Man.
They don't see any difference. They believe that that is completely and wholly discriminatory. They wanted to get in at the kindergarten level and start
mm-hmm.
telling children, just because you have a pee-pee doesn't mean you're a boy. You need to experiment and find out who you are. You need to try this and try that, and you need to be with these and to be with those. You cannot let – the guy might have made a mistake, and maybe you aren't supposed to have a pee-pee, and maybe one day you can get that taken care of. And the people like Barack Obama of the world not only think that you can get it taken care of, but they want you and I to pay for it.
Right. Well, it's going towards – everything is – I mean, eventually, I don't think we're going to have male and female. I think it's just going to be we're neutral, or we're, you know, we're other and neutral, you know, because it seems
yeah.
like if you're female, then you've discriminated. If you're male, then you've discriminated. So we have everybody the same in a social justice world that Barack Obama lives in, and everybody can just be neutral or other, and that way there's nobody who's going to be left out.
That's what they want.
That.
That's mm-hmm. what they want. What they fail to realize is that there is a big difference between equal and equivalent. Men and women
mm-hmm.
may be equal. Men and women are
right.
equal and should be equal, certainly in the eyes of the law and things like that. Nobody
mm-hmm.
thinks it's a good idea. Nobody thinks it's a good idea for you and I to both do the exact same work, the exact same amount of work, the exact same volume of work. I get paid $20, you get paid $10. Nobody thinks that's a good
mm-hmm.
idea. We're equal in that regard, but we are not equivalent. Men
right.
are different than women. for the most part, men are larger. For the most part, you know, we have 9 pints of blood, you have 6. We can do more physical work. We can, you know, we're capable of sustaining more physical activity before we start passing out and number of accidents per hour starts going up, stuff like that. We're not equivalent at all. And certainly when it comes to parenting, and this is what they really want. This is where they want to tear down the roles completely. The fact of the matter is, men are better fathers than women. Women are better mothers than men. They don't believe that.
Yep.
And that's why the president had birth certificates changed from mother and father to parent one and parent two.
Yeah. And I was going to say, they pretty much eradicated fathers for a long, long time in the liberal and progressive world. So they trying to kind of get rid of them. But when you're talking about being equivalent, you know, there's in the news lately, there is Obama has said in the military that, you know, you've got to have so many men and women, and they want equality in the jobs in the military with both men and women. So let's make it happen. And I guess women now are really having trouble passing the training that's required in order to, I believe it's officer training. And I know that it's very tough. And so, you know what he's going to do. What do you think he's going to do now that the women can't pass the training?
Water down the standards even more. The standards are already different as they need to be. So for men, I believe in the Marine Corps, to get out of basic, the men have to be able to do, I think it's 11 chin above the bar chin ups in 30 seconds. Women have to do a flexed arm hang because we're not equivalent. Women don't have as much muscle mass. Women, your center of gravity is placed differently. A chin up is very few women can do one, let alone 11. It's just not how you're built. You know, the 1 mile run, men have to complete it in whatever. I don't have this memorized, but let's say it's 6.5 minutes. Women have 8. So what do we do now in a combat situation? So, you know, we've inserted women into frontline combat units. And you've got a unit of 30 people moving over rough terrain in Afghanistan, hopping over rocks. Taliban's in pursuit. They're less than 2 hours behind them, whatever. And one of the women can't keep up. Now as a commander, now as a lieutenant or a captain or a major or whoever you are as an officer, you have to make a decision. Do I potentially sacrifice this entire unit and slow down and only go as fast as the slowest member can go, or do I let that member fall behind and they're on their own? Well, there's no decision there for an officer, of course. You're going to have to slow down. You're not going to leave a man behind or a woman behind. And now we're putting that entire unit at risk because people want women to be equivalent to men when they're not.
Yeah. And you know, there are always the exceptions that there are some women that can outshine a guy, and you know, I mean, a small little guy or something like that. You know, and you're going to always find that. And so this is, I know exactly what you're saying, and I want everybody to understand. I think they do. We're not putting women down. We're just saying, you know, this is the law of nature. It's just what it is. I mean,
I'm not putting women down. I love women. Women are equal but not equivalent. Now, yeah, of course, anybody can point to. And this is what liberals do when you start talking about stuff like this, is they run to the extreme of the examples. And, of course, there's exceptions to every rule. We all know that. You know, one of the things that a liberal got into me, I was asking what their problem with the Ten Commandments is. You know, pick one. Which one's the problem? You know, honor your mother and father, is that a bad thing? So you're saying that if your father was Adolf Hitler, you're supposed to honor him. Well, yeah, we can run off to the extreme of examples all day. But in general terms, speaking by and large to the 90th percentile or higher, generally speaking, men are bigger, faster, stronger than women. There's exceptions, of course.
Right. And it's just the facts. And people don't want to look at the facts. They don't want to look at the truth. But you have to do that, you know, because then we're living in a fantasy world if you don't, and you can't compare apples and oranges and make something happen if you're not willing to look at the truth. You know, one of the things that I read another article that you wrote about women and equal pay. You know, Obama's always, let's pay women the same and all that, and yet he pays the women that work for him, they get paid less. And then nobody ever says anything about that. That's kind of, you know, very quiet. But you had an article where you brought up Ann Coulter, Condoleezza Rice, and Michelle Malkin in regards to you know, having them come in to different college campuses and talk. And then you brought up, the reason I brought this up about the pay, you brought up Janet Napolitano. But do you remember the article that you were talking about with Ann Coulter and Condoleezza Rice and how they were turned away from the different college campuses?
I do. That actually isn't all that old. I think it's a couple of months ago. And the genesis of that article, you know, we're getting a lot right now about income inequality and helping the middle class and helping the poor and all this stuff. And, of course, liberals have taken over academia, especially college campuses. The most liberal cities in the country are Ann Arbor, Berkeley, Madison, Gainesville, you know, where you find the major universities. Those are your epicenters of liberalism. Well, my oldest son and I went to the University of Colorado versus UCLA to the basketball game at UC Boulder. And as I drove around the campus, I got to looking at the faculty parking lots, and I noticed that the faculty parking lots are filled with Mercedes-Benzes. So, you know, these are all public employees, so you can research this stuff and find out. And I got to looking into the UC system, the University of California system. These people, these liberal professors, Janet Napolitano's contract is, anyone can find it. It's not hard to look up. She was paid, if I remember, and I'm going from memory here, but I think her base salary was $437,000 annually. She was paid
It was a total of $570,000.
Then on top of that, she got a moving bonus of about $145,000. Then on top of that, you, the taxpayers of California, are renting her a house for about $10,000 a month. Then on top of that, you're giving her an annual car allowance, because apparently $500,000 a month isn't enough to drive to and from work. You're giving her a car allowance of another $9,000. I mean, this woman, and it's not just her, and as you go through the ranks of the pay scales, you find out that all these professors out there, and California isn't unique in this regard, they're all making serious cheddar, $400,000 a year. Then Barack Obama or Jerry Brown or somebody gets up and talks about income inequality and how the poor are getting poor and the rich are getting rich and we got to do something about it. They stand there and clap and write papers about how right they are.
Right.
Get back in their new BMW and go to Spago for a $50 lunch.
I know.
A bunch of hypocrites on planet Earth are running universities around this nation.
I know, and then we talk about how, you know, the students can't afford to pay the tuition and we've got to help them, but, you know, we need to look at sort of the root of everything about how these people are getting so rich off of the students, and as you said, you know, a $570,000 salary is what she does. Is that equivalent to that type of salary?
I'd take it in a heartbeat. The root issue is hardcore liberals in this country are the most hypocritical people in this country, and that's all there is to it. You saw with Sony Pictures that was hacked by North Korea and a bunch of their emails exposed and stuff a couple of months ago. Well, you look across the top of the hierarchy at Sony, the people in the corner offices, the people with C after their last name, CEO, CFO, you know, the big money ballers. All white male over 50. There was one Asian woman up there. Other than that, it's just white men over 50, 100%, but they're screaming about diversity. And liberals do this all the time. They want their ideas forced upon you, but they don't want to have to live by them themselves.
Right. Well, because they think they're right and we're wrong, and no matter what, even if it's the same thing, they're still right. and you know, They absolutely hate women like Ann Coulter and Condoleezza Rice and Michelle Malkin. I mean, just anytime they don't have to say anything, they can show up and the venom comes out. You know, I don't know.
Yep. They're not big on diversity of thought. They're fine with all the choir preaching in the world. Now, of all places on a college campus, you would think that would be the number one place in the country where diversity of thought is encouraged. Let's stimulate discussion. Let's stimulate conversation. Let's bring in people who specifically don't agree with us so we can hear their points of view and talk about them. Not at all. And the women I mentioned in that article were all invited to speak at a college campus and had to either rescind or be canceled because their safety was in jeopardy.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the way they look at diversity, I mean, they do, you know, accept diversity and embrace it. It's just the diversity between liberal and progressive. So, you know, it's all in how your definition of diversity, you know.
Exactly. We want to hear any and all points of view as long as they agree with us. And somebody like
somebody like
Connie Rice, I mean, here you have an accomplished black female concert pianist, university provost, former cabinet-level member, Secretary of the State of the United States of America. If anyone on the liberal side of the – if anyone should fit the liberal mold of who we want to prop up, pedestalize, hear what they have to say, at every chance we get, we got a black woman who served as the Secretary of the State. This is the model. This is the role model. This is the person we want to hear. Just the opposite. The runner out of town on
a
rail.
Just the opposite. Absolutely. Yeah, she's tainted by the Bush taint, you know, so she's sold out, so I guess we can't have her. And you're right, she's absolutely the epitome of what type of person they should be embracing and saying, look what we did. This is who we got in as our, you know, in our Democrat Party, and they don't do that at all.
Sarah Palin.
My question, it's what?
Sarah Palin. Sarah Palin. Mm-hmm. So here you have Sarah Palin. You've got a mother married to her high school sweetheart, mother of five, mm-hmm. one a special needs child, who decided, you know, I don't like what's happening in my community. I'm going to run for and get on my school board, got on the school board, didn't like what she saw there. I'm going to run for mayor, became mayor of her city, ran for and became governor of a state, did a very good job as the governor. This is woman power. This is the example. This is I am woman, hear me roar. This is feminazism. Mm-hmm. They should be bowing down and worshiping before this woman. Prove that you can do it, that you can maintain a family, that you can cook and clean and do all that stuff and govern and have a professional life and be feminine and be beautiful and all that stuff. They hate her guts.
They hate her guts, yep.
It's not about diversity. It's about ideology.
No. Right, exactly. And you know, because of the fact that they wouldn't, you know, in these universities, they wouldn't allow these conservative women in. You know, I don't know if you go to college campuses and things like that. I was wondering how, if you did, how receptive they were to you coming in there as a conservative to try to talk to people on college campuses.
I don't much. It's not my niche. We're more focused on the ethnic minority thing than on the young person thing. And I learned a long mm-hmm. time ago, be excellent at one or two things rather than mediocre at four or five. So
mm-hmm.
we don't do a lot of work on and around college campuses. I'm a graduate of the University of San Francisco. I just put a post up about my poor alma mater yesterday, going full tilt liberal on me. But I don't do a lot of speaking at college campuses. Been invited to a couple here locally, and that's about all.
Because I was wondering, you know, if some of these young black men and women, you know, if they would be good to kind of try to get, I don't know where they stand exactly, but in some of those that were very progressive and liberal, if it would be try to kind of easier to get them to change than it would be people who have been, you know, for 50 years liberal and progressive. What are your thoughts about that?
You know, there's no they. So your question is, would it be easier to get them to change? There's no they. Everyone's an individual, and that's the way we have to approach it. There are certainly our college-aged black kids who are very open to different thoughts, ideas, points of views. And there are some who are militant liberal, you know, Malcolm X poster on the wall and all that stuff. So there's no generic approach. The way we began the conversation holds true with that population, and that is first, build the relationship. Second, pursue the votes. People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. The issue that you have with these people is they don't feel like we care. And until we mend that, it doesn't matter how good our approach is.
Yeah, the reason I asked that is I had another guest on that they do go around to different college campuses. That's what their group does. And they feel that, you know, trying to get the young people to change and try to get that age group can be very, I don't know, rewarding, I guess, for them to try to convince them to become conservatives. And they've had luck going into college campuses, but they're not all the time welcome there. You know, the colleges like to say, oh, gosh, you know, we were going to set you up here, but, you know, now we've got to move you over here. They're trying to kind of get you out of the way.
Not real big on the diversity of thought thing.
No, not at all. And we have about 5 minutes left. I wanted to ask you, you were talking about the with me when I talked to you the other day in regards to the video, the British guy that talked about Obama and Islam and all that and Islamics in general. You want to talk a little bit about that in a few minutes that we have left?
I don't know if people have seen it, but it's a brilliant piece of film. It's basically a guy talking to the camera and talking about how easily offended Muslims are, which they are. But, you know, and I'm writing a column on this now. A lot of people ask the question, and it's a good one, is Obama a Muslim? Is he this? Is he that? And all this stuff. And my answer to the question is, I don't know, and neither do you. I mean, we don't know. I cannot look into a man's heart, nor can you, and figure out, has this person made a decision for Jesus Christ? Is this person a disciple of the prophet of Muhammad? I don't know. What Christ said was, you examine the fruit. That's all we have to look at. And when I look at the fruit, when I look at the clearly sympathetic position of foreign policy this man has toward Muslim extremism, when I hear the things of the pastor that used to preach in the church that he sat in but didn't pay attention for 20 years, when I see him canceling celebrations, ceremonies for the National Day of Prayer at the White House, when I hear him say things like the Holy Quran, which is all he says, he never says the Holy Bible, he only says the Bible, but he never says the Quran, he only says the Holy Quran. I, as a Christian, would never say the Holy Quran. I would not allow those words to come off my lips because I don't believe it is holy. So when you begin to examine the fruit, you get a very clear picture of what the man's core is. Is he a Muslim? Mm-hmm. I don't know, and I probably never will know. Hope to one day. But that's not the point. The point is, where is the fruit? And I'm really troubled about the future of our country as it comes to terrorism and terrorist attacks on our soil based on the fruit that I see coming from the Oval Office.
Yeah, absolutely. And he lately, just the other day, and it may have been today earlier, that he came out and said that we are safer under his watch as Americans than we have been, you know, since 2001. We're safer. So I have an article coming out on that, kind of my opinion about that.
Yeah. It leads to a very obvious question, and we all ask it. The question is, number one, is he a liar? When he says these things, is he just knowingly not telling the truth, or is he self-deluded? Does he actually believe the things he says are true at the time he's saying them? And I frankly don't know which on this particular one. I think he may be that self-deluded. He may be that full of himself, that egotistical and narcissistic, that he thinks he's doing a great job. And he believes we really are safer. And that's almost worse than if he were just lying.
Absolutely. No, I absolutely agree. And I think, you know, it puts us in more danger each and every day because he's not willing to admit that there are Islamic radical extremists or even that there's terrorism with Islamists. So, I mean, it does put the country in danger and more every day that we have to fight these type of things and sit and wonder, gosh, does he really believe what he's saying or is he okay?
No,
what's the point?
He believes it. There are people in the world who simply refuse to admit the truth that we all know. The truth is, it's not because we're mean, it's not because we're too big or too powerful. There are people who are convinced that the world is inhabited by, indeed is ruled by, infidels. And the infidels are to be given one of two options, bow a knee to Allah or be slaughtered. They were simply refused to believe that those people exist.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. Well, Derek, I want to thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure. It's gone by so fast. I hope that everybody checks out your website at blackandconservative.com. And please come back and join us another time.
You invite me back, I'll come back.
Okay, sounds good. We'll do that, all right? So you take care.
Will do. God bless.
God bless. And I want to thank everybody for being here tonight. I think Derek was wonderful, and he certainly gave us a lot of information to think about. I hope you have a pleasant week, and stay safe out there. And please check out my article, probably being posted tomorrow at SusanKnowles.com. So God bless, and I'll see you all again next week. Take care.